Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
They're getting ready for an impeachment trial of the Homeland Security Secretary of Alejandro Mayorkas. And they are there in the Senate, and people are milling about, and it'll only be a matter of time before things begin. Meanwhile, President Trump is on trial in New York. Now, Wednesday is an off day, right? They do have the ability to have off days from the trial, just not when Trump is supposed to go to his son's high school graduation. And people are angry about this. How dare you not let the man go to his high school graduation? What kind of madness? What kind of absolute madness is this? And then some say, wait a second, isn't Trump the guy who brought me 15 days to stop the spread or reduce the curve or something about the curve and the spread? And I couldn't see my grandfather when he died because they wouldn't let me in because of COVID. So I don't give a good holy damn whether Trump goes to his kid's high school graduation or not. There's real anger out there. But if we're going to look at this the way we often look at things, which is politically, one should recognize that to not let Trump go to his kid's graduation is, without question, a win for Trump. It's a win. And it's weird that you, the court, are going to make Trump look good and sympathetic. Tony Katz today. I forgot if I said hello. 833-468-8669. 833-GOT-TONY. We know that this whole trial is like nuts, right? There's no crime. This is ridiculous. It is madness that this is taking place. What's more maddening is how the press is covering this story. I don't know if you caught this or not. I had caught this. Producer Carl had caught this. This was CNN. CNN, MSNBC, and the like are covering this trial. This is the hush money trial, right? Trump had some kind of relationship with Stormy Daniels. I don't know. Somebody got spanked. They didn't get spanked. I'm not sure. I wasn't there. If I was a betting man, someone got spanked. And then there was hush money. Hey, don't tell anybody about this. And then someone said, well, I want a bunch of money. And then somebody else said, here you go. So Trump said, don't tell anybody. Stormy Daniels said, I want a bunch of money. And Trump said, here you go. There's no crime here. You may consider it seedy. That's what Ellie Honig of CNN stated. You might consider it seedy, but it's not a crime. It's not a crime. I never understood this when people were talking to Michael Avenatti. Did Tucker refer to him as creepy porn lawyer? Was that it, Producer Carl?
Yes, it was
creepy
Tucker.
Porn lawyer. The guy who tried to blackmail Nike out of $25 million. The guy who Brian Stelter said could be the next president of the United States. Meanwhile, Michael Avenatti is in jail and Brian Stelter is a potato somewhere, wherever it is the potatoes hang out. The whole potato thing came back. It, honestly, just treat yourself and just search Brian Stelter potato. You decide it is not for me to connect people to their spud lookalike. There's no crime that took place here. None. Zero. And I never understood the whole Avenatti insanity. I never understood why anybody paid attention to the Stormy Daniels story. It never made sense. Well, they are covering this over there at the cable nets and at some of these so-called news organizations like this is a royal wedding. Like they're expecting someone to get married and Meghan Markle will pop out from the shadows saying, I see all you racist bitches. I know y'all hate me. Like they are just ready for anything. And this is how they're covering it. Ellie Honig speaking to Wolf Blitzer.
I think potentially revealing details about these seven jurors. These jurors will be on the case. So far, we know four males, three females. Let's take a quick look at what we have for juror number one. Juror number one will be the foreperson. No magic powers associated with the foreperson. That's the person who generally communicates on behalf of the jury with the judge and tends to lead the deliberations in the room. What jumped out at me, this nothing remarkable in the bio, but this is a person who said he watches both Fox News and MSNBC. That's an interesting combination. If I'm Trump and I got anyone who watches any Fox News, I want a chance that that person is going to go on the jury. But I have to note this. In New York, I pick juries in New York. People sometimes confuse Fox News with the local Fox 5. And the jury form does not separate those two. So it could be that he was actually talking about the local news, which is really not partisan.
I don't know if the guy watches Fox News or watches local Fox. That doesn't matter. This is what we're doing. There's a whole NBC report about juror number one likes long walks on the beach and looks at this news and follows, gets their news from Facebook and Google, gets their news from the New York Times and Facebook, gets their news from TikTok and a guy in a street corner who drools to himself. This is going on. This is what constitutes news. It's unbelievable. You don't have anything else to cover? There's nothing else going on? All of these assignment desks, you're like, all right, you're on the Trump coverage, right? You're going to cover it from the angle of Trump. Did he fall asleep today? That's going to be front page news. All right, you're going to cover it from the jury perspective. What's it like to have to be on a jury with an insurrectionist, all right? You're going to cover that angle. You're going to cover the racist angle. How is Trump being a racist in the courtroom, right? So you're going to cover that. You're going to get that done, okay? So we got all the angles covered. All right, good. And you cover if justice was involved. Like we care about that. All right, let me see what else is going on around the world. Nothing else. All right, guys, this is the whole story. This is all we're doing. It's all Trump 24/7. All right, thank you. We'll have a meeting again in 20 minutes. As if nothing else is happening in the free world, they're approaching this thing. They're all out of their minds. They're all certifiable. If you ever wondered what bloodlust looked like, sounded like, take a look at the people. Take a look at the people who are following this trial and think that, oh, this is how they're going to get them. Oh, this is how they're gonna get Trump. Meanwhile, you've got an impeachment going on with Alejandro Mayorkas. And in classic Senator Kennedy style, the senator from Louisiana, he is on Fox and Friends this morning, rocking the light gray. And he's got his take.
No. Well, he, under Senate precedent, he does. Look, this is what's going on. It's pretty simple. Schumer's trying to muddy up the water to make it look deep, but it's pretty simple. The United States House of Representatives, after months of investigation, has brought very serious charges against Secretary Mayorkas. You ought to read the charges. Now, this is the United States House of Representatives that has done this. We're not talking about some game boy who's living in his parents' basement and has an opinion. This is the United States House of Representatives. It's only happened in 22 times in our 250-year history. Every time the Senate has done its job and held a trial, except when the public official impeached, quit. Now, Senator Schumer says, this is just a policy disagreement. There are no high crimes and misdemeanors. How does he know? He hasn't seen the evidence. Let me tell you what's really going on. Schumer says this is about principle. To quote one of my favorite columnists, if you think this is about principle, how did he put it? You also think Elvis is alive and running a small bait stand on Lake Erie. This is not about principle. This is about raw gut politics. The loon wing of the Democratic Party, led by President Biden, does not want the United States Senate over a two-day period to present evidence of how the Biden administration has screwed up royally the southern border right before an election. That's what this is all about.
The man has a way with words. It's about politics, as we have stated. For this trial, it's going to get started. I'll bring you what I can from it. I'm Tony Katz, and this is Tony Katz Today. Jackson has given up with Hobbits and is now all about the Beatles. Peter Jackson has been working on recreating the documentary of Let It Be, the 1970 documentary. He restored it. Peter Jackson was involved in the restoration of the song Now and Then, which took this recording they had of John Lennon, and then they were able to add in a guitar part from George Harrison, the late George Harrison, and then they brought in Paul and Ringo to fill in the rest, and they put together this new release from the Beatles. Tony Katz. Tony Katz Today. 833-468-8669. 833-GOT-TONY. So the documentary is going to Disney Plus. I don't know why Disney Plus. Do they? They don't own the Beatles catalog, do they? I don't think they do. The restored version utilizes some of the outtakes that from the film, the docuseries, The Beatles Get Back. That was 2021. And so now they've got this. It re-premieres on May 8th and is expected to get a tremendous amount of visual. I don't mind the Beatles. I've got songs that I like. If I were to do a list of best Beatles songs, if I were to ask you your list of best Beatles songs, we might have a very different lists. This is the Rolling Stone list of greatest Beatles songs of all time. All time. Should I just do the top 10? This is what they have. And by the way, Hard Day's Night does not fit into their top 10. Number 10 is what I actually think might be one of the finest songs ever written. Knocks me over every time, and every remake that I hear of While My Guitar Gently Weeps, just, oh, the song is spectacular. Written by George Harrison, I'm putting it as the best thing they've ever done. And that's like kind of nutty, right? It's a hard thing to say. This is the best thing that the Beatles have ever done. Number nine on the list. Number nine on the list. Come Together. If you were a bass player like me, you enjoyed the song a lot. I don't know. I could take it or leave it with that being in a top 10 of Beatles songs. I don't know if Come Together is there. It's not like it's not there. I just don't know if it necessarily is there. Number 8 on the list is Let It Be. Oh, I would put While My Guitar Gently Weeps way above Let It Be. Number 7 is Hey Jude. Ooh, good choice on number 6. You see, you forget like the older stuff. And I don't even know. It's weird to say Beatles and older stuff, right? But good song. Attracts me like no other lover. But, yeah, this could have been afterwards. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how. I think I just have a thing for George Harrison. I think that's clearly what's going on here. On their list, by the way, so it's the Rolling Stone list of the 100 greatest Beatles songs of all time. Number 5 is In My Life. Number 4 is Yesterday. All right, that would be in a top 10 list. Number 3, Good Work. Good Work. Number 3 is Strawberry Fields Forever. Absolutely. It's the first time you knew the Beatles were doing a lot of drugs. Like, an outrageous amount. So what gives us our final ones? What are the last Beatles songs as this new documentary heads over to Disney Plus? Who still has Disney Plus? Who still has? That's a question. I thought a lot of people got rid of that stuff. Number two on the list. Where is it right here? Okay. It's I Want to Hold Your Hand. That's the older stuff. That's how they started. The song that changed everything. But here's number one. Number one, which was not released as a single, just so we know, was released in June of 1967. Called A Day in the Life. This is not a bad choice. And I hate Rolling Stones politics. Oh, with great passion. Jan Wenner is garbage. But maybe they got this right. Maybe they got this right. Nah, I still think I'm on my guitar. But this is a good song. And just everywhere it goes, how it kind of flows out. The new documentary launches May 8th over there at Disney Plus. But forget that. I'm playing us out there, producer Carl. This is Tony Katz today. Turn away, but I just So the Supreme Court does not seem to buy the argument that somehow certain codes and certain rules and regulations can be utilized against January 6th protesters. Specifically, rules that came from a 2002 piece of legislation known as Sarbanes-Oxley, and how that legislation refers to the idea of interfering with the work of Congress. This was meant to apply to an accounting firm called Arthur Andersen in the days of Enron. Now, the people who think that everybody who disagrees with them is an insurrectionist, they want to use this against people who were in the Capitol on January 6th. But that doesn't seem to be what the legislation was all about. Tony Katz today. What's going on, everybody? William Jacobson joins us right now, Cornell Law professor, the mind behind legalinsurrection.com. And you always, you know, at the end of the presentation to the Supreme Court, you're always, you know, you're looking for body language. You're looking at things that the court says and whether or not they're going to vote in favor or vote against or how they might go. The feeling was that, yeah, the people pushing this look about how to go after people regarding January 6th isn't going to fly. Talk to me about what it is you saw during yesterday's presentation.
Well, it was one of the more humorous, subtly humorous arguments I've seen, because Justice Gorsuch threw in a couple of references that a lot of people may not have picked up on, but were pretty funny to those of us who cover the media and cover events. One, he used the phrase mostly peaceful protest at one point, which of course is the joke about how the media called the riots in 2020. And then he also made a reference to whether pulling a fire alarm in order to delay a vote could be a violation of the statute, which of course is what, I forget his first name, Bowman, the Democratic congressman from New York, did.
Jamal Bowman is the name you're looking
for.
Jamal Bowman. And hold on, stay right there, because this is actually how it sounded.
C1 and C2, and make clear that C2 does not cover the conduct that's encompassed by C1. Now, I acknowledge that there
were... Beyond saying, okay, C1 does some things, and the whole rest of the universe of obstructing, impeding, or influencing is conducted by C2. Is that a fair summary of your view?
Yes, but there was a good reason for Congress to do it this way.
Oh, I
trace
understand.
It to the statutory history.
I understand.
And I would just say that...
If I might. So what does that mean for the breadth of this statute? Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify, or at the State of the Union address? Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify?
I mean, that is unbelievable, Professor. That is stunning to hear. But through it all, Neil Gorsuch is asking this really kind of valuable question about the legislation, and it has a Section 1 and a Section 2. The legislation is clear about obstruction. But it's really about destruction of documents, which is not what the people involved in January 6th did. So on its merits, does the government have a case against this man, Joseph Fisher, and against other January 6th defendants?
It may have a case, but not under the statute. I mean, and that's the whole point of this court case, which is that this was a statute developed to prevent the, destruction of the books and records, destruction of documents during a criminal investigation, or in order to, disrupt a criminal investigation. It was not meant as a general catch-all for anything that in any way, shape, or form might interfere with an official proceeding. And that's with the examples that Gorsuch and some of the others were putting out there. Well, what if there's a perfectly lawful, peaceful protest that happens to delay somebody getting to a vote? Is that a violation? And so basically, I think the examples they threw out, as humorous as some of them were, really, I think, went to show that the government is overreaching with its interpretation of the statute, because otherwise, where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line if somebody, is a heckler? Is a heckler now going to serve 20 years in prison? somebody, and they used examples, what if somebody stood up in the courtroom right when they were having the argument and, you know, delayed things for 30 seconds? Is that a violation of the statute? And so they were all these examples thrown out. And basically what the government's left to saying is, trust us. Okay, well, we wouldn't prosecute something like that. But that's not the whole point of the court system, is not to trust, you know, the executive branch. It's to be a, you know, to be a check on them, a check and a balance. So I would be very surprised if the government wins this case in the Supreme Court, if they're allowed to proceed under the theory that any interference with any proceeding is covered by the statute. What they'll do with regard to this specific person, I don't know. They might send it back down for more hearings on what he did, what he didn't do. But, you know, and I'm sure the government will, I forget if this person has other charges against him, but there are many people who were, I think 300 or 400, who were only charged under the statute. And if the Supreme Court says this statute cannot be used to apply to actions which interfere with the legislative vote, that's not the purpose of this statute, that's not the wording of the statute, then I think government's going to be scrambling to see if it can find new charges against people.
Talking to William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, the mind behind LegalInsurrection.com. Let me shift gears on you just a little bit, because this broke today. I thought it was important because you have the piece up at LegalInsurrection.com about the NPR editor, Uri Berliner, writes the piece over at Free Press discussing how NPR has lost their way and is clearly a biased outfit. And NPR, of course, is government funded. And he then, because he wrote this piece, got suspended without pay. Well, it's now today it comes out that he has resigned. He puts out a resignation letter to NPR. I am resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I have worked for 25 years. I don't support calls to defund NPR. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and to do important journalism. But I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cite in my Free Press essay. I want to take you through two parts of this, because you and I, with LegalInsurrection.com, me with radio, we are in the same business, which is content creation. And we're both, you know, in order to survive, we need listeners, we need people reading, advertising, etc. First conversation is about this idea of defund, but I'm actually going to make it the second conversation, and let me go to the idea that Uri Berliner, after being suspended, thought the proper and only course was to resign. As you hear this, because, I mean, this all just broke today, what is your take on his move there?
Well, I think it's unfortunate when people resign because they give up a whole host of potential legal rights to their, you know, their job. Not that anyone has a right to a job as such, but the point is you can't be fired on certain bases. And I don't know if he would be protected for, you know, being fired for exercising his free speech and his opinion. But he's, you know, you give things up when you resign. And so I hate to see somebody do that, but maybe he just, a lot of people don't have it in them to fight with, a big employer, you know, in which NPR is. So maybe he just wants to move on. That could be a perfectly legitimate, valid, personal decision. But, you know, I think it's unfortunate that he resigned. I think it would have been better off to give them the discomfort level of him still being there.
Now we move it into this idea of funding. He doesn't call for NPR to be defunded. NPR very much seems like it is government competition, government paid, government funded, taxpayer funded. We're funding competition. And for I speak personally about you and I. Maybe you see it differently. I certainly will tell you I see it this way, that it is funding competition, and government-accepted competition is very much picking a winners and losers kind of concept. I do favor the defunding of NPR, and if people want it, they can go about paying for it on their own. Is this are you somebody who favors that? Do you have a different view than I do on what NPR is, maybe, and whether or not it should get our dollars?
Well, first of all, I think NPR has a variety of sources of funding. I'm not sure what percentage actually comes from the government. I don't think it's the bulk of it. I think it's mostly corporate money, corporate donations, private donations. So I'm not sure the government defunding it, how big an impact that would have. But even if it has relatively little impact, well, why should we be paying for this? Well, the more reason, if, you know, cut them off, you know, let them be an independent media company. I don't know why we're funding NPR. It's clearly been biased. It's clearly, has a political agenda. He just exposed what really I think most people understood. Maybe it was worse than most people understood, but everybody understands NPR is, you know, a lefty, you know, liberal / leftist, media company. So why should we be paying them anything? I think cut them off completely. Doesn't look like it's going to actually have a huge impact on them, but, we shouldn't be paying.
I've got more to get into with William Jacobson, including the situation on the campus of Cornell University, which is really a situation on campuses all across the country. I'll come back to that, my conversation with William Jacobson. I'll get to more of that in just a little bit. I'm Tony Katz. This is Tony Katz Today. Jerome Powell has made it clear that he listens to this show and is listening to you. The economy is not in a good place, and there will be no rate cuts. Let me say that again. None, zero, zip, nada, nunca, zilch, garbage, crapola of rate hikes. I don't know if that last one fits, but I liked it. Tony Katz. Tony Katz Today. What's going on, boo? 833-468-8669. 833 got Tony. Jerome Powell is clear that inflation has gone nowhere except up.
Inflation, of course, declined quite significantly over the second half of last year, over the whole year, but particularly in the second half. But 12-month core PCE inflation, which is one of the most important things we look at, is estimated to have been little changed in March over February at 2.8%, and the 3 and 6 month measures of inflation are actually above that level. So we've said at the FOMC that we'll need greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2% before it would be appropriate to ease policy. The recent data have clearly not given us greater confidence and instead indicate that it's likely to take longer than expected to achieve that confidence. That said, we think policy is well positioned to handle the risks that we face. If higher inflation does persist, we can maintain the current level of restriction for as long as needed. At the same time, we have significant space to ease should the labor market unexpectedly weaken.
Well, I like that you put a little bow on that to make everybody feel better, but there's nothing to feel better about regarding this economy. We are where we are. And where we are is in a pretty bad spot with interest rates that are not historically at the highest levels, but interest rates that are clearly higher than we would like them to be. You have got the 30-year fixed. I mean, it's based on the 10-year Treasury. We go over this often. The 10-year Treasury is actually a little bit down because it was at 4.675, 4.8. That was just last night. So it could pop back up. But you're talking about a 286 basis point spread right now between the Treasury and the 30-year fixed. And the 30-year, how do we not have a sponsor for the mortgage rates? I mean, we just do it all the time. The 30-year fix, according to Bankrate, is 7.03%. According to Lance Lambert, News Lambert on X, who is formerly the real estate editor for Forbes, now runs his own gig, you're talking about 7.5%. That's what people are finding out there. That's the real average. 7.5% mortgage rates while housing prices don't come down. Bad news for anybody looking for a house or anybody looking to sell a house. You need some people who've got real incomes or are real desperate. The first one, terrific. The second one, problem if you're somebody who remembers what happened to the economy when things got desperate. Well, we'll just sell a house to anybody. Well, it doesn't matter. We'll do ninja loans, no income, no job, and we won't really check things. Ah, what could go wrong? I swear to you that we don't learn these lessons is nutty. I do have a little bit of fear of that for the real estate market. The larger fears, as we've discussed, is what's going on with the amount of borrowing that's taking place from people's 401ks and the amount of, what's the word that I'm looking for? Oh, that's right, credit card debt. $1.12 trillion. See, I can't even say it, it's so big. $1.12 trillion, fourth quarter of 2023. When those defaults start going en masse, and we've talked to Dr. Matt Will, economist, University of Indianapolis, about this, and he hasn't seen that, right? He hasn't seen the toppling. I got to wait for that? You know what happens? We're not economists. We're out there living our lives, doing our jobs. We know exactly what happens. We know exactly how that plays out for all of us, how much more difficult it is to get credit, therefore how much more difficult it is to build a business, buy things, grow things, gain those opportunities to attract capital. Things slow down. Oh. No rate cuts? Yeah, no rate cuts. I had said maybe we'd get a gimme at the end of the year, maybe. And I guess that's still possible. Nah, I'm voting against it now. I guess everything's possible. The inflation is there. The rate cuts can't happen. And 2024 is going to be as rough as we thought. So all we have to do is now deal with that reality, as opposed to the markets that don't deal with any reality whatsoever. That's just precious. This is Tony Katz today.